The year is 1870. Construction begins on the Brooklyn Bridge. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution is passed, giving black Americans the right to vote. Christmas is declared a national holiday. Alexander Calder, Vladimir Lenin, and Maria Montessori are born. Charles Dickens and Robert E. Lee die. And on November 20th, the Metropolitan Museum of Art opens in New York City at 681 Fifth Avenue. There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Mm-hmm. 2020 is the 150th anniversary of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The amount of amazing true stories contained in the walls of this hallowed institution is nearly infinite. But today we're talking about a different kind of story. Christine Colson worked at the Met for a quarter of a century in a variety of roles. She left a couple of years ago to write full-time, and the result is her debut novel, Metropolitan Stories. Andrew Bolton, curator of the Met's Costume Institute and annual star-studded Met Gala, says, quote, "More than any scholar or connoisseur, Christine Colson's exquisite book captures the essence of the Met, its ability to delight, surprise, astonish, and ultimately, to dream," end quote. I guess I'd like to begin with talking about your history at the Met. You worked at the Met in various departments and all kinds of different areas of the museum. Can you talk about the vast experience that you've had? It seems like your experience in the museum world is quite unique.
You know, I started there as an intern in European paintings in the summer of 1991 and probably had the best job I'll ever have, which was to sort through the correspondence between the great American painter Mary Cassatt and the amazing collector and suffragette Louisine Havemeyer. And so I was given a box of their letters, and I sat there and read through them and had to categorize them so that the curator, when he was writing his essay, would know what was in each one, and it would make it easier for him. Because of that, I was given a very big office of a curator who was on sabbatical. And so my taste of museum life behind the scenes was very grand and very glamorous. And when I went off, I went off to graduate school and came back, and I was an assistant in the development office, which was my first real job there. It was exactly the opposite. I shared a desk with someone else and sat on a stool and spent most of my time delivering mail. And so I was always glamour adjacent, but but not particularly glamorous. And, you know, in some ways, my secret skill was always that I could write. And so that moved me around a lot. And I was in development. I was writing exhibition descriptions, and then I was writing proposals and collaborating with curators on foundation work and government grants. And then I worked on a project to acquire the Brooklyn Museum costume collection. And I worked on Philippe de Montebello's retirement. And I kept developing this portfolio that was mainly driven by my ability to write the Met story. And then I was a speechwriter for Tom Campbell for 8 years. So he followed Philippe de Montebello as director of the Met. And so I served in a lot of different departments and capacities, but I was always a sort of writer, speechwriter, ghostwriter, And then my last, I took a sabbatical in 2017 to write the novel, which I was very grateful to the museum for allowing me to do that. And then when I came back, my final position was as senior writer at the museum, and I was working on the wall text and object labels for the new British galleries that will open at the end of this month.
So, you know, when you started at the museum in 1991, in some ways, that couldn't have been that different from if you had started in 1971 in terms of technology. I mean, that's pre-internet, you know. And so you kind of got in at a time period where you had a taste of kind of the, you know, mid-century museum world, right? And then you were able to kind of...
Well, this book very much takes place in my first 10 years at the museum. There is no email in this book. It is a completely analog world. And that was important to me and a decision I made very consciously because I wanted to capture how I grew to kind of own the museum, which was very much a kind of physical relationship with the museum that I don't think, you know, young assistants now get. If you're delivering the mail, you have to learn to traverse that 4-block-long, 2-block-deep building in the most efficient way possible, which is sort of up and down and across and over and through the galleries and then through a side door. And it put me in the room with a lot of important people, you know, these kind of larger-than-life characters who were running the museum then, who, if I were now an assistant, I would sort of see their names on email, but not have that sort of glorious exposure that physical proximity gives you.
It seems like, you know, one of the things that's great about the book and the way you've written it is obviously you can very much tell that you know this place inside and out, but it seems that you never, having worked there as long as you did, lost the sense of wonder about the place and and the fact that you were lucky enough to kind of have this other world that you inhabited for most of a 30-year period. And museums kind of are their own little planets. And the book to me almost reads as if it's a travel account of visiting another world. You know, the Met is its own its own ecosystem. You talked about
that.
it's a, you know, the Lonely Planet Metropolitan Museum of Art book. But you talked about the fact that you were a speechwriter for the director there. I think most people would be shocked to find out that a museum director would need someone to write speeches. You know, it almost sounds like as we're talking, talking about a presidential candidate or something. People don't really understand how museums work and the kind of cliques and microcosms that are all in there.
Yeah. People go to the Met, you know, in New York, they go to the Met once in a while. Some people go to the Met once in a lifetime. And I got to live there for 25 years. And I wanted to capture what that was like and how that changed my relationship with not only that place, but the works of art in it, the people who also worked with me there. I wanted to write almost about two collections. You know, the works of art, which in this book I've given some human characteristics to. You know, the second chapter is written from the perspective of an 18th century chair in the Reitzman Galleries. And the collection, which is the staff, and who I treat as kind of exquisite works of art in their own right. And I wanted to capture what it is like to exist within that place and share the devotion that very much is the underpinning for how a place like that functions from all points of view. You know, the book is 16 vignettes from different perspectives, from the chair to the guy who changes the light bulb, the director, the curators, people who sweep the floors. I wanted to take those different points of view and have the reader understand the connective tissue between all of them, which is this incredible dedication to that place and the bigger idea that it represents. And I think that that idea you have of this place is this kind of enclosed city. It is an empire into itself. And one of the things people don't understand about a place like the Met is that nothing is outsourced at the museum. We have our own plumbers, our own electricians. You need something made of plexiglass, we have a plexi shop. Everything is done in-house. And so you do wind up with this incredible microcosm of people and obscure jobs that are created to sustain that museum and its mission. But at the same time, as hierarchical as it can be, there is a sense that everyone has a role to play within this sort of big show that we're presenting every day.
Yeah. So, you know, if the Met had its own government, what kind of government would it be? You know, would it be the dictatorship? Is it a republic? Is it, you know, like, you know, how would you kind of describe the interdepartmental politics of the whole thing to make it work as its own entity?
This book takes place under the directorship of Felice Montebello, who was the director of the Met for 31 years and very much defined and embodied that institution in those years. And he was an extraordinary leader. I don't know what kind of government he was leading, but I can tell you, as the lowest person on whatever totem pole that was, I knew exactly what that man wanted from me. And his standards of excellence really infused the work that we all did in the service of the museum. And so I think that kind of clarity, that sense that what we were doing was nothing short of magnificent, is an incredible thing to be a part of. You know, I devote an entire chapter to the curators. They are, to me, the great talent in the museum, their eye, their scholarship, their minds, what they've seen, how they see, is so exceptional that all the work that we do is really in the service of what they bring to the institution. But, you know, they're kind of a pain in the ass, too. And so, and they should be. They're, you know, these extraordinary creative people. I think they're like dancers at the ballet. I was always infinitely replaceable at that museum, and those curators are not. They are the talent, and everything should sort of feed into gaining and fostering the work that they do. And that's what you see in the galleries. That's what the public experiences.
How long do you think it took for you to really feel ownership of the space? Meaning you started in 1991. It's a big thing to tackle. And I don't just mean trying to figure out where every door is and how to get around the place, which I'm sure takes its own amount of time. But having that sense of being and understanding it, you know, was that something that was ongoing, or was there a time period where it all kind of fell into place?
I think that, you know, ownership of the place comes pretty easy when your job is to deliver stuff. But you don't have any credit at that place until you've been there for 10 years. So I think there's a sense of aspiration that exists up to that 10-year point. And then you get like a tiny little slice of cred because you've been there that long. But, you know, my colleagues and I really grew up there together. And so, you know, these are people who knew me in my 20s. They, you know, watched me get married and have kids. And so there is a kind of shared history that we have that very much fed into the work I was doing, even when I was in more senior positions, because there was a kind of innate trust in knowing someone for so long, having made mistakes together, having had triumphs together. I think that very much underpinned the work that we did and the trust that was involved in getting it right.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Mr. Know-It-All. You go to the museum hoping for a peaceful experience, but sure enough, there's a group of people gathered around one loud guy who seems to know everything, or at least one thing, about every artist, painting, sculpture, and architectural detail in sight. You could be annoyed. That's fair. But hey, try thinking of him as a volunteer tour guide. Stay close enough to him to hear the fun facts, but just far enough away to ignore him when the need should arise. And that need will indeed arise. Thanks and no thanks, Mr. Know-It-All.
What was it that made you want to write this as a work of fiction rather than, you know, a memoir about your time there? I'm sure you have a million true stories that could have easily made a book of essays or a memoir. And I'm sure many of those stories filtered their way into the novel as well. But what was the, you know, decision-making process behind that?
Yeah, I mean, this is deeply informed fiction. So I think you have to be very true to the details. I never mess with the location of galleries and works of art, and the rituals and vocabulary of the book are very much based in the real life, day-to-day functioning of the museum. But what I wanted to write about was something that was much more magical than that, which is that thing that happens in the museum when the public isn't there. What I wanted to capture had to be written with a degree of surrealism. And I don't love the words magic and surrealism, but to me, those are the most realistic parts. You know, when the chair is talking, like, I hear it. And so I wanted to write it in this way to get people to start to think about those objects differently. And I think, truthfully, a gossipy memoir would have been pretty tedious. I wanted to introduce people to a world, as you suggested, that they don't even know exists. This sense that there is something in those galleries that you can experience that actually doesn't have to do with scholarship or art history or what's on the labels, and comes from time and experience and a kind of sensitivity to what those objects carry. And I thought by introducing that idea into a novel, people could maybe start looking at that place in a way that wasn't so intimidating.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about the book is that I think if you never had the chance to visit the Met in your life, but you stumbled upon this book, it has enough of a 360-degree experience within the book to still be a great experience without having that firsthand knowledge. Did you think about that in terms of, you know, how the reader would respond to it? Not everyone is lucky enough to take trips, visit New York and whoever, but, you know, how would they, what would their relationship be to the book having never been to the Met?
Well, and I think it's been interesting. I've been, you know, out on tour for a few months now and meeting those people who sort of love the Met, but a lot of them have never been there. They like the idea of it. And they all have their own experience more locally in their museum. And I think they're able to see what I've written as not just a book about a specific place and a specific time, but about the world of the imagination and a way that you can apply this way of thinking to anything that you look at. I think there's also something about mundane tasks in an extraordinary place that speaks to a lot of people. The people who do the quiet work and are quite anonymous but critical in institutions like this, they exist in museums across the world. And so giving them life and a voice and a sense of humor, I think bringing all of that life into the storytelling really helps make it a human story about finding your tribe. And for me, about, you know, finding my voice and having that experience for, you know, I didn't take notes for those 23 years before I sat down to write. I knew these stories the way you know the stories in any family, because we repeat them over and over and over again. And that oral tradition of any close-knit culture has its own lore. And I liked the idea of taking some of those kernels, those by now deeply inaccurate stories, and building characters around them and making something out of that wonderful detail.
I love, you know, you mentioned this earlier, the idea of telling a story from an object's point of view, and, you know, you anthropomorphize a chair, for example. Was that something that you had been wanting to do even when you were thinking about the book? Was that one of the early ideas? Say, hey, you know, we should tell the stories from the object. Now, this is obviously one of the reasons why it's fiction. That wouldn't necessarily work in a memoir to tell a story from a chair's point of view. But how do you get into, it's one thing to get into the voice of another person, but how do you kind of find the voice of a chair, for example?
I would argue you find the voice of the chair by spending a lot of time with the chair and listening and sort of thinking about it. You know, I often recommend to people that they stop trying to conquer the Met or any other museum of a comparable size, and that they actually just walk through the door, wander through the galleries, find something that just stops them in their tracks, and then spend 15 minutes looking at it, really looking at it. Not the average, you know, the average person looks at an object for 6 seconds or something like that, but really spend time with it. Look at the edges, look at the corners, ask yourself why the artist made the choices that they did, and spend that 15 minutes doing that hard work, doing that looking, And then the most important thing to do is just leave. Turn around, walk out of the museum, and that object will stick with you all day, all week. You'll have a different relationship with that work of art for the rest of your life. And so what the objects I've chosen to write about in this book are the objects that I spent time with during my tenure at the Met. I mean, these are the objects, these are nobody's masterpieces. These are mine. And so they're very obscure and they tend to be pretty random. And these are the objects that I went to. These are the objects I spent time with. And so my imagination took flight as I was consoling myself or enjoying the beauty of them. I mean, I find a lot in those galleries that's very comforting. One of the objects I talk about from the perspective of the work of art is an early 16th century, early Renaissance marble statue of Adam. And that's a statue that in 2002 actually fell from its pedestal. Its pedestal collapsed and it was destroyed. And in that moment, which was like a death at the museum, I remember it well. It was a Sunday night and we found it on a Monday morning. There was a moment in which I thought, I wonder what it felt like for the sculpture to be in the air. That moment when it was off the pedestal, not when it hit the ground, but that this thing that's never supposed to move is suddenly in flight. And I think that says something about my mind and why I, you know, hear the object speaking. But that idea of that...
Like it felt a moment of escape for a moment from the kind of...
Like suddenly there's this must be an incredible moment of release. I mean, it's just sort of this whee!
Yeah.
And so that was the first thing I ever wrote for this book,
yeah.
Is the two paragraphs describing what that sculpture felt like in the air. And I loved writing that way. I loved trying to think in that way. So to me, it was a natural way to think about an object that speaks very powerfully to me and on almost a daily basis. These works of art have a real role in your life when you live there. And I think that is the underpinning of the entire book. I mean, I say it in the first line. You know, we the staff, think we're protecting and saving these works of art when the truth is these objects are really protecting and saving us. I mean, I think there's a reason people stay there for so long. I think there's a dependency that we have on those works of art for all kinds of things.
Yeah,
solace and comfort, and you know, beauty does that.
I wonder, you know, by not picking the quote unquote usual suspects that a lot of people might think a book about the Met would cover, have you heard from any of your colleagues there if there's renewed interest in some of the pieces, or people come in and looking for some of the pieces,
you know,
that you're talking about in the book?
I've heard there's been some interest at the information desk in wondering whether there's a tour of these objects. And in fact, I'm about to put up my website, which links you to every object referenced in the book, because they are pretty obscure. So I've given a couple of tours taking people around these works of art. And it's a nice way to look at those works of art after you've read the book, because you do see them differently. There is a different kind of resonance once you've given them a different story. And so, yeah, there has been a little interest in wandering around to find these things, and they aren't very obvious. So I like the idea that those more distant galleries are getting some action.
You mentioned the word magic earlier, and it could be easily overused, but it really does apply to places like this. A few years ago, the Met started doing a social media campaign on Instagram with the hashtag Empty Met, which is on days when the museum was closed. They would show the galleries with no one in there because the spaces are usually so packed full of people. It's, of course, one of the busiest cities in the world. It's very rare to get a chance to see the space like that. And people really responded to that. And I wonder if you could describe for us on those moments where you had the museum all to yourself, where you're walking through the galleries and you just really, it feels almost more like a sacred space, or you just kind of commune with it in a different way, what that's like to be in a place like that and really feel like it's all yours for a moment or two.
Well, and that is the classic fantasy, isn't it? It's the, you know, that great book from the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler that everyone read as a kid, where the kids sleep over at the museum. I think as we now as grown-ups have the same exact dream. And that's what happens when you are working there. And there are so many mornings and so many nights when you are alone in those galleries. And the power of those galleries when that show lighting isn't on and all you feel, you know, is the sort of the atmosphere of time and place, and you just hear your own footsteps on those marble floors. I think there is simultaneously an incredible sense of the people who preceded you in those spaces, some other young woman who used to deliver the mail. I think that institution is filled with ghosts and its own history, a sense of a collective ambition that started 150 years ago and that you are continuing. But then I think there's another kind of collapse of time when you're looking at a 4,000-year-old statue. You know, I write in the book about an Egyptian statue from the tomb of Mekhet-Re of a young woman who in some ways was a kind of ancient avatar for myself and all that I aspired to. And I would often visit her because she was at once incredibly modern and universal, but also so specific that you feel like if I saw that woman in an elevator, I would know exactly who she was. And so that collapse of time, I think, is very powerful, but often something that's hard to experience when the galleries are filled with people. Yeah. When it's crowded, you kind of get caught up in that white noise. And so that silence and that intimacy that exists when you're there on your own allows for a different kind of energy.
You know, for those who are listening that don't believe in the concept of magic, you just totally unprompted brought up the great book From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler by E.L. Konigsberg. And today, the day we're recording it, February 10th, just so happens to be her birthday. So what a strange moment.
Is it?
What a strange moment. So I think that's a great place.
I love that.
It's a great place to end on about this kind of weird world that we live in. Thank you, and we really, really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Great. Thank you.
Most museums wouldn't or couldn't exist without a robust donor base, but sometimes that relationship gets complicated. In 2019, in the midst of the opioid crisis and after a great deal of public pressure, the Metropolitan Museum of Art announced it would stop taking donations from the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma, makers of OxyContin. The decision followed the actions of other museums, including London's Tate Modern and the Guggenheim in New York City. To quote Daniel H. Weiss, president of the Met, "The museum takes a position of gratitude and respect to those who support us, but on occasion, we feel it's necessary to step away from gifts that are not in the public interest or in our institution's interest. That is what we're doing here." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.